Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Who's Christian? After pushback and proselytizing from Latter-day Saint lawmakers, the Pentagon revises its list of religions. Senator Mike Lee ignites controversy after adding a roadless rule repeal to a wildfire bill. And University of Utah officials announce plans to build a major new health campus at the Point in Draper. Joining me later in the program will be religion reporter Tamara Kemsley and reporter Courtney Tanner. And we'll start with reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. Let's start with, got a couple of stories with Senator Lee. This one is, a attempt by Republicans in the Senate to add a controversial, amendment to a uncontroversial bill. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so on Wednesday in the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, Senator Mike Lee and his fellow Republicans voted to add an amendment to what was previously framed as a bipartisan wildfire bill. It's called the Wildfire Prevention Act. It would have instructed the Interior Department and Agriculture Department to, you know, set targets on things like prescribed fire thinning to prevent wildfire on public land. So they added in this amendment that would repeal the roadless rule, which as it currently stands prevents logging and road building on nearly 59 million acres of national forest land.
This was instituted in 2001. I guess that there is a disagreement on whether this is a good or bad thing. Senator Lee obviously doesn't agree with it.
Yeah, so Senator Lee and I would say Utah elected officials in general have been pretty opposed to the roadless rule for a while. There's lately a lot of the kind of back and forth on this has been whether or not this does or doesn't help in wildfire prevention and suppression. But also, you know, there's been a lot of debate over the years about closing off national forest land to off-road vehicles or logging and industry. So the debate on this runs deep in Utah.
Well, those who do support the roadless rule, what are the benefits of this that they see?
Yeah, I mean, the benefits they see are that it, you know, helps protect millions of acres of national forest land, and that also has an important economic contribution for recreation economy. That was something that Democratic senators talked about a lot in this committee meeting earlier this week. And then on the wildfire side, the roadless rule does not prevent, any sort of kind of hazardous fuel management activities. There's still some activities that can be done, and research has shown that that is still happening. So they argue that it isn't stopping sort of this wildfire prevention work from happening, and that also, the majority of wildfires in the West are started by humans, and roads can increase humans in these national forests, or, you know, even the presence of the road. Sometimes these fires are started by chains dragging or people parking on, you know, dried grass. So there's this debate of whether the roads will in fact help or make the wildfire situation worse.
I'm looking at a map you include in this story of wildfire potential danger areas. A lot of parts of states are included. Utah, the entire thing is red.
Yeah. So Utah for June and July, in these wildfire projection maps, forecast maps, above average for all of June and July for wildland fire potential. You know, we had a exceptionally dry and hot winter, and so that leads to high wildfire risk this summer.
Are there any studies that have been done on the effect of roadless roads or not on wildfire suppression or prevention?
Yeah, there are quite a few studies. And, you know, when this issue first came up last summer when the administration, like sort of in tandem to this amendment, the administration also for the past year has been going through more of an administrative process to try and undo the roadless rule. And so we've been talking with scientists about this for the past year, and there have been various studies. And I mean, one thing that some of it I've mentioned that, you know, they've found that the roadless rule has not stopped wildfire prevention activities. They've found that, like, there is not, over the 20 years of monitoring data, it is not like supported that getting rid of the roadless rule would improve forest health. You know, they're seeing opposite in some cases. And then, I mean, something that's kind of interesting is that one study found no difference in wildfire severity across roadless and roaded areas. Fires in some places are reaching a greater extent, so they become larger in roadless areas because, you know, it's more difficult to contain fires in remote areas. But actually, this study in 2021 found that Utah was kind of an outlier in that, and that fire extent was actually pretty similar in areas with and without roads in the state. So, you know, the research is showing that, yeah, roads can help firefighters access certain parts in the forest more easily, but that also humans are causing most of these fires. So it's complicated. You know, it's not sort of just a clear one way, but in general, yeah, there's not sort of like this, I don't know. Roads are not all bad, they're not all good. It kind of goes both ways in terms of what you're talking about with wildfire.
So this repeal of the roadless rule, that was an amendment to the Wildfire Prevention Act. That repeal, potential repeal, is controversial. The Wildfire Prevention Act itself seemed to be bipartisan. What would that act itself do?
Yeah, so the main things that act was is I mean and still is aiming to do is directs the depart public land agencies to set targets on wildfire prevention activities such as, you know, thinning forests, prescribed burns, things like that, and to increase those targets from where they are at currently. It also instructs these agencies to do more like monitoring and transparently post what these activities are. So that's sort of the main, some of the main points of this act.
Let's turn to another story. The headline: Mike Lee says there should be consequences for states that sue over the Colorado River. So that gets us into Colorado River and the squabbling seven states that are part of the Colorado River system. So I guess the point is, several states are do appear to be gearing up to sue the other states.
Yeah, and I mean, I should say Utah included. So it was an interesting, you know, in addition to Mike Lee in this committee hearing, the same hearing on Wednesday when this rule issue came up, they also held a hearing on the Colorado River. In addition to Mike Lee, Amy Hawes, the executive director of the Colorado River Authority of Utah, also, you know, spoke up saying that Congress should not reward states that sue another Colorado River state. But Utah is among the states that has set aside money for potential litigation. And, you know, how I've heard it talked about, it's mostly in defense and in preparation in case another state sues Utah. But yeah, Utah set aside around $6 million that could be used for Colorado River litigation. A big chunk of that could also be used for other, you know, water litigation, say around the Great Salt Lake or something like that. But how it was talked about in the legislative session earlier this year was, you know, the Colorado River lawsuit threats were a big motivating factor behind securing that money.
So there's seven states, upper basin, lower basin. Remind us which are the upper or which are the lower?
Yeah, so upper is Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming. Lower is California, Nevada, and Arizona.
And the problem is not enough water to go around potentially. What so the lower basin states, what's their beef with the upper basin?
Yeah, so as you said, there's less and less water going around. We have a over 100-year-old Colorado River Compact that was written at, a time when we had more water, and very different economies, populations, all these things. So this year, guidelines that were set up a couple decades ago to figure out how to manage this river system in dry years. Those guidelines expire this year, so the states have been in negotiation the past couple years to figure out what they're going to do once these expire because we're still in drought. But the states, especially the upper basin and lower basin, is kind of two, contingents of this, have had a hard time agreeing. And the lower basin specifically wants the upper basin to commit to what they're calling verifiable water reductions. And the upper basin wants the lower basin to commit to not sue them, if there's not enough water in the system to flow downstream. So those are some of many hang-ups between the two parts of the basin.
So we have a little bit of time. Let's go to a third story. This is from last week. Important one. The Colorado River's largest reservoirs are heading toward a system crash, experts warn. System crash, what does that mean?
Yeah, so how the scientists and lawyers who wrote this latest paper, what they're defining system crash is if basically there's not enough storage in the reservoirs along the Colorado River. So, think Flaming Gorge, Lake Powell, Lake Mead, to keep basically those reservoirs at a level where water can still smoothly flow through them, where hydropower isn't shut off, things like that. So, I've been on here talking about this a few times, but Lake Powell is approaching what's called minimum power pool, the level where water can no longer flow through the turbines that generate hydropower, and water instead has to flow through these lower outlets that weren't set up to be the main outlet that the reservoir consistently flowed through downstream. So there's concerns that, below that level is this really sort of what these experts call realistically accessible storage if there's, potentially threats to the infrastructure below that point. So the system crash is essentially water levels are getting so low that the infrastructure that 40 million people depend on could be in a rough spot.
One thing they're doing this year, I believe, is letting a lot of water out of Flaming Gorge so they go down and help Lake Powell.
Yeah, exactly. So they are releasing between 660,000 and 1 million acre feet of water from Flaming Gorge this year. To prop up Powell, they're also reducing how much they let out of Lake Powell to try and prevent it from dropping below that minimum power pool elevation.
So it's all with that's all within the upper basin, right? So lower basin still needs their allotment of water.
Yeah. So less water will be flowing downstream to the lower basin. And that's where this, what we were talking about earlier, this threat of litigation comes in because we are, with the lower releases, and especially if this has to happen, next year or into the future, getting into this territory where, lower basin states at least would say that the upper basin is breaking the Colorado River Compact. And there's a lot of, different legal opinions about that, but that is why this threat of litigation is becoming more and more eminent, if you will, just because we are, getting into these numbers where people could make legal arguments that the Upper Basin isn't meeting their obligation.
Now, the federal government, I guess, is set to release a 10-year plan. I think everybody wants to get something in place by the new water year, which is October 1st, right?
Yeah, so they have obligations legally. They operate these reservoirs. The federal government is considered the water master in the lower basin. So they have obligations to deliver water. They have obligations to manage these reservoirs. And so the water year at Lake Powell begins October 1. So they have to have guidelines in place by then for how they manage that reservoir. And as I said earlier, those guidelines, are expiring this year. So they need new ones in place. And they have said they plan to release a 10-year framework this summer. They're currently going through the environmental review process. So they should have a final environmental impact statement out this summer and a final decision shortly after that. And they've said that they still want a seven-state deal. Basically, if they do get a seven-state deal, that's what the operation plan will look like. But at this point, it's not appearing that the seven states will agree by the timeline the feds need to plan. So it sounds like they'll have this broad 10-year framework and then update it every couple years in hopes that the states agree to something.
Well, we'll stay tuned. I'm sure you'll be covering this as it goes along. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thank you. I know you have to get going, work on a story, so I appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank
Bye.
you. Bye now. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And following a break, here's the headline we'll be talking about. University of Utah officials announced plans to build a major new health campus at the Point in Draper. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. So let's treat this story first. University of Utah plans to build major new health campus at the Point in Draper, according to officials. I guess maybe starting with the Point, this is where the prison used to be, right? A lot of new real estate, and I guess this is a big new addition to that.
Yeah, this is a really a long talked about spot. So there was the state prison there, and then it was demolished and moved. It's closer to the Great Salt Lake now, and this real estate, this land is coveted, is how I would put it. It's in this corner of Salt Lake County that's really growing. It's been called the Point because it's at the point of the mountain, and there's been a lot of plans talked about for what's going to go here, and now we finally have a little bit more detail.
So, what is University of Utah going to put in here?
Yeah, so they are calling it, the University of Utah is calling it a health campus, a medical campus. But the board that oversees the Point of the Mountain development kind of gave a little bit more detail, I guess we could say, and they are saying it's going to be a hospital, a full-scale hospital at this spot.
So I guess that's good for a medical school to have a hospital. You do, residencies and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it'll be kind of interesting. So currently the U obviously has its main hospital on campus in Salt Lake City, and then it's actually opening another hospital in West Valley City in 2028. So it'll have the two, and then this would be a third hospital.
What are some of the other things envisioned for the Point? That's a lot of land out there.
It's a lot of land. My coworker Tony Semerad has done some excellent reporting on this, so I've got to give him a shout out. He did an article last year that talked about how there's more housing going in than was anticipated in the original plan, which is really interesting. They've kind of shifted a lot. There's been competing projects. So if you think about, the B Stadium at Daybreak or the kind of big sports district plan for downtown Salt Lake City, those have ended up kind of making the point at, in the point in the mountain a little unsteady, I guess, if you could put it that way. And so they've kind of had to shift their plans as those other projects have happened. And so, yeah, there's more housing going in there, in addition to the multifamily housing that was required as part of the original plans. And then they have a big entertainment venue coming in. And now this U Hospital, I think the original vision also called for like a lot of green space. So I think we're still kind of in the early phases, but we'll keep seeing what goes in.
So this, if I understood the story right, a little bit different. The state controls this land. They're leasing land to most everybody else, but they sold this land to University of Utah.
Yeah, that's right. So it is a unique agreement here, and there's a lot of uniqueness within it. So like when the point leases land in a traditional agreement, some of the sales tax from the business that goes on there goes back to this point of the point of the mountain state fund so that they can kind of help pay off, debts here. So yeah, it's interesting that you will actually own its land. It's a separate agreement.
One of the things that stood out to me, University of Utah Health, bigger than I thought. This is just the health portion, the budget in the billions.
Yeah, it was really interesting. So this new health campus was approved during a University of Utah Board of Trustees meeting this week. And kind of separately, they also just discussed the budget for University of Utah Health. There's new requirements from the legislature to have the Board of Trustees review those budgets more closely. And so just kind of lined up that they were also talking about the budget. But yeah, $4.6 billion in annual revenues. Which is a lot of money. And then 4.3 billion in expenses, and so they end with about $303 million in gains.
What's a rough timeline for when this hospital, this medical campus would be open?
That's a great question. I think there are just not a lot of answers to that right now. We kind of tried to press the U on that, and they were like, well, we're going to defer. Until this June 25th meeting, where the governor is going to announce this sale agreement with the U, and hopefully we'll get some answers then. I think it would be a long time. So the West Valley City Hospital, that's in construction and on time, is not going to be open until 2028. So if you kind of use that as a gauge, I mean, we're still looking probably a ways out, I would guess, into the 2030s.
Somebody in the story pointed out hospital is kind of a different design. You can't design that as fast as a regular building.
Yeah, there's so many considerations. I mean, if you just think about like what a hospital needs, the secure rooms and surgery rooms, and there's so much more that goes into that. So yeah, I think that also, delays how quickly it can go up.
I'd like to move to another story. This is just published this morning. There's a huge market demand. The University of Utah approves a new bachelor's degree in artificial intelligence. I was amazed in the story. University of Utah taught an AI course in 73, apparently.
Yeah, that really stood out to me too. I found that fascinating. Obviously the discussion around AI feels very new, and very recent. But yeah, it's actually been going on for much longer than I knew. So yeah, there was the first course in AI was taught at the U in 1973. And the course listing is surprisingly interesting. It lists the very same foundations that this new degree in AI will have.
There's a photo here, this great photo, Computer Center, University of Utah, 1970. And these are those huge computers that we used to have, right? That taking up entire wall.
Yeah, I thought this photo was really fun to include just because it shows that the U does have this huge history with not only AI, but with computing and with technology just generally. I mean, it really has been a foundation for the industry and for growing this. I mean, there's so many connections between the U and if you think about like Pixar and the internet and it's really fascinating history to dig through.
Let's bring it up to present, I guess, future as well. What will be included in this bachelor's degree in AI?
Yeah, one thing that I thought was really interesting is there and alleviated some concerns that had come up is there will be a specific course on how to deal with AI responsibly, how to learn about like any ethical implications with using it. So in addition to that, the traditional AI things that you would probably think about, math, computer science, machine learning, some robotics, some of the natural things that would be included. But the ethics course I thought was particularly interesting.
Right now, you note that some universities offer master's degrees in artificial intelligence and related fields.
Yeah, in Utah. So there's technically no bachelor's degree in AI in Utah. So this will be the first, but there is a master's program in artificial intelligence at Utah Tech University. And at BYU, there's a master's in computer science where you can specialize in AI. And the U has similar tracks for like master's and PhDs in computing. And that's kind of the trend nationwide is kind of upper level degrees for AI. There are bachelor's degrees too across the country in AI. So the U does join those ranks, but mostly higher degrees.
I suppose the legislature will approve this because it is considered a high demand field.
It is a high demand field, and the legislature has been very interested. As we've talked about on the show before, in high demand and high wage degrees from university, they did the budget cuts and reallocations, so the universities had to essentially cut millions from their budgets and reallocate those to fields that were considered, more high demand. The legislature doesn't review the degree, but it'll go next to the accrediting agency. So we'll see kind of where it goes from there. I do believe the Utah System of Higher Education probably signs off on it too, but there's no hiccups expected. I mean, this really is a degree that so many people are in support of. So I think, it's good sailing from here.
One official quoted here says this will not cannibalize the regular computer science program. So I guess there is potential concern there if he's, saying it's not going to do that.
Yeah, one of the trustees at the U, Bassam Salem, brought this up. He was kind of concerned there already is a degree in data science at the U under the computing school. And it is a closely related field, but I thought the distinction that they countered with was really interesting. Data science focuses on understanding and using data to make decisions. AI is more about creating systems that can do that own analysis itself.
Oh, I wonder if we could move to a couple of older stories. These are from last week, but since we have here a little bit of time of interest, BYU's medical school, which was announced, what, a couple of years ago, looks like it's on a fairly fast track as these things go.
Yeah, it's actually been really surprising. I definitely think it's moving at a very quick clip. It was announced in July 2024, and I think it's pretty likely that students could start classes in fall 2027, based on the new information that has come out. There's an accrediting visit this month, and so it's really just on track to move forward.
So yeah, potentially students at the school next fall. Yeah, which means I guess students be admitted this fall or early next year.
Exactly. Yeah. And I should note that Dr. David Morton talked about this too on his YouTube channel. He has been at the U's medical school and is moving to BYU's new school. And so he said the same that students could be admitted this fall and starting next fall.
So remind us, BYU has announced a focus for this school. It won't necessarily be competing with U of U's medical school.
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen as far as competing. There's always more demand for doctors. So I think kind of inherently it's good to have more medical students. But yeah, the school said it's going to focus on international health issues affecting members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which, as we know, sponsors and owns Brigham Young University, and then also the church's humanitarian efforts.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of other medical schools in Utah. This is osteopathic medicine, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. So they do different kind of degrees. They're degrees in osteopathic medicine, or DOs, as opposed to MDs. So that's Nordic College in Provo and Rocky Vista University in St. George. In addition, obviously, to the U, which is kind of the main medical school in the state and does MDs.
One more story, if we could. A story about Westminster University. They made a list. This is not a good list.
No, and it's interesting, you know, that the school has pushed back substantially on this ranking, but Forbes magazine does like an annual list based on the financial health of private colleges and universities in the country, and it gave Westminster University a D grade.
Mm-hmm. Which I think they don't have an F grade. I guess F is when you fail financially. So they're saying, Forbes is saying they're on the verge of financial failure.
Yes, F would be they've closed. So yeah, D is the lowest grade possible. Forbes considers this on the brink of having to shut down because of financial concerns. Westminster, you can read it today. They did an op-ed that basically tries to counter this and says, you know, that they're in good financial standing. So it's kind of interesting to see where it goes from here.
So what is Forbes saying the problem is? I think declining enrollment, maybe?
Declining enrollment is a big one. And I did review the student data sets on this, and they show a very large decline in students over the last 10 years, 57% decline just in that decade, which is, you know, it's that's steep. They have a little more than 1,000 students right now.
And again, Westminster is pushing back on this. They're saying they're in better financial shape than Forbes is portraying.
Yeah, that's what the school says. So the Forbes rankings are based on what data is publicly available, and financial data always lags a little bit for schools. So like the forms that I looked at, the 990 form that is submitted to the federal government, the most recent available is for the fiscal year that ended in June 2024. So, you know, about 2 years behind. And Westminster says that they're in healthy financial status right now. So there's not really a form that is public that can show that, but that's what the school is saying.
Did any other Utah schools make this list?
Yes, Brigham Young University is on the list, and also Western Governors University. You have to have more than 500 students to be on the list. So there is kind of a cutoff there, but BYU got an A+ ranking, and Western Governors University, which is an online school, received a C.
Okay, yeah. Well, Courtney Tanner's been telling us about a bunch of these stories. Courtney Tanner, reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, thank you so much.
Yes, it's been great to be here. Thank you, Tom.
You bet. By the way, do you have an underplayed story you want to tell us about? Wait, I didn't prep you for this.
I will point to one from Megan Banta, a reporter at the Trib. She went with an individual to kind of look at the land that's being eyed for a hyperscale data center in Box Elder County. And it was just it's a really beautiful story about what that land holds, you know, the birds and the grasses and the water and the water in short supply. I mean, it's just a really beautiful examination of what's there.
You check that out at sltrib.com. Courtney, thank you so much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Thank you. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And following a break, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Here's the headline. After pushback and proselytizing from Latter-day Saint lawmakers, the Pentagon revises its list of religions. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, very interesting story. It's got national headlines. Here's the headline. Who's Christian After pushback, proselytizing from LDS lawmakers, Pentagon revises its list of religions. So the Pentagon put out a list, right? What was that list? What were they trying to do?
Yeah, so this is a list of codes that are appear on dog tags for individuals who enter the military. And so they're kind of this important identity marker for them. And then on the part of the chaplain corps, it's helpful because this is what they look for when they are assigned to a unit and they want to know how to meet the spiritual needs and what's kind of the religious makeup of that unit. They look down and can use these codes to quickly identify the different individual affiliations within that unit.
So one of the issues that some people had with this, they took the number of codes, I guess, and reduced it.
Yes, from some 200 to 31. And overwhelmingly, the ones that were removed were minority, and especially pagan, including university or others, including Universalists, Unitarian Universalists, and then you had atheist, deist, all of those were axed from it.
Now, causing a bunch of angst for Latter-day Saints was the at least appearance that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was no longer listed as Christian.
Well, it was, yeah. So what it did was that it then applied a tag that said Christian to this new updated listed to 20 different faiths, including some minority groups like Jehovah's Witnesses. It did not, however, include that tag in front of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which was the only group that identifies as Christian that was left off this list.
So various elected officials from Utah protested, right?
Yes, all of the delegation complained online. The most loud was Mike Lee, Senator Mike Lee, who at one point really was uploaded this video of himself where he's very animated and he tells Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, he says, "Tear down this wall." Of course, a reference to the Reagan speech to Gorbachev from way back when. And sure enough, the following, a few days later, according to Mike Lee, thanks to President Donald Trump, the list was again updated. However, this does not mean that Christian now appears on this list in front of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Rather than apply that label, the DOD simply removed those tags altogether. So no faith is now labeled as Christian.
So you just have a two-letter code, I guess. CJ is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I'm reading from your story. BA for Baptist and so forth.
Right.
In the meantime, a lot of debate flying back and forth on social media. Senator Lee, I guess one of the things he posted was encourage everybody to read the Book of Mormon and then come back and tell him whether the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was Christian.
Yes. So, lots of back and forth. The church itself just said, hey, view our FAQ page, which at the very top, question number one is, are Latter-day Saints Christian? It says, yes. And then, of course, there are many talks of church leaders who explain that we preach of Christ, we teach of Christ, including President Oakes, the current leader, recently in a worldwide address to members of the church. So the church has really not got into the fray. It's let the politicians who are members of the faith really lead the front here.
You quote Texas Pastor Joel Webben. He's pushing back. I believe he does not believe the church is Christian.
Right. There's quite a few who disagree with the decision to change the list, or I should say agree. agreed with the DOD's designation in the first place of withholding that label. Webin, Joel Webin in Austin, Texas, is a particularly vocal online critic of the church. But there are many others, including some more recognizable names that are a little bit more mainstream and certainly have some sway when it comes to the White House. So you have people like Ali Beth Stuckey, who is a very popular evangelical podcaster and political commentator. She jumped into this fight. You had all sorts going back and forth, members of the church defending their status online. And you have a mix of people who are saying, look, it's not even about, in some cases, you know, they're trying to argue Jesus Christ is our name. We worship him. We see him as our savior. And then you have others who are just like, regardless of what you other evangelicals think about what we believe, it is not the government's place to weigh in on this theological dispute.
I think that's essentially what John Curtis said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not the government's place.
Not the role of government. He also said he was working to reverse this prior to its reversal.
What about the congressmen and women for Utah?
Yeah, similar. Just a lot of sort of up and down condemnation and concern about what this could represent or what this represented in terms of the relationship between church and state.
Senator Lee said he talked directly with the president about this.
Yeah, he took primary credit for this reversal, or again, it's not so much a reversal, but sort of like a net large shift. He said that he, previous to the announcement of the new list, the one without any of the Christian designations, he posted on X, I had a great call with President Trump. President Trump loves Latter-day Saints. And so he was really sort of focused all of his criticism on Secretary Hegseth while praising President Trump throughout this process.
Now, you note that this is a rare break with the administration for Senator Lee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very supportive of Trump and the administration, the MAGA movement. But again, like I said, he has been very careful and I think very savvy to identify this as a Hegseth problem, not a Trump problem.
In the end, what is the Department of Defense officially saying, I guess, about the original list and then the change?
Yeah, it just says like, hey, look, guys, you're reading too much into this. This was never meant to connote sort of like, you know, any sort of theological designation. That is the spokesperson for the DOD saying that. Pete Hegseth himself kind of undermined that, saying things about like confirming that he has a sense of ideology that has driven him. He says in previous administrations that the chaplain corps was, quote, infected by political correctness and secular humanism, and that this is part of him trying to fix that, quote, drift.
So this is, I guess, of primary use to chaplains, is it? And what are chaplains saying, if any?
Yeah, I've spoken to a couple of chaplains, former chaplains, who are concerned. They are concerned that this is not, first of all, they have agreed that this wasn't really a problem to begin with. That, if anything, greater specificity in what individuals believe is helpful. For instance, one former chaplain I was talking to says, you know, if I don't know that an individual in my unit is atheist, then how am I supposed to respond appropriately in that individual's final moments if I happen to be there for those? And so what they fear is that this is really kind of a signal from the Hegseth-led Department of Defense, and that there is sort of this ideological shift that there, or vision of what is or isn't real religion being applied from the top down.
Do you think what you'd like to say about this story?
I think just that there is something to say about all of the ones that, yes, the list was updated. I think a lot of Latter-day Saints declared victory, but you still have a whole lot of, yes, minority, but nonetheless, for many people, real religious affiliations who are not, haven't been part of this conversation, who have been left off and continue to be left off this list. And so that is something to continue to watch.
On Behind the Headlines, we've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thank you so much.
Yeah, take care.
And thanks for listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with me again next time.